All right, so can you hear me okay and stuff?
Yeah, man.
All right, good, man. Let's see. The first thing is I would like to ask, have you ever seen sickdrummer.com or seen Sick Drummer Magazine yet?
I did see it the other day.
All right. First time,
I thought it looked great, man.
Yeah, well, that was my first question was, what do you think of the idea behind a Sick Drummer Magazine, I guess, versus the other drumming magazines who, until we came along, really never touched on the extreme metal?
It's beautiful, you know. It's something that we need for our genre, and it's a great thing to have, you know. I mean, sometimes the metal community kind of gets overlooked by, you know, the larger media, so to speak, and so it's great to have you guys there covering this stuff.
Nice. Okay, so going back now, I guess, to start it off, and you've probably been asked every fucking question that you could ever hope to be asked or whatever a million times by different people, so we kind of try and come up with a little something different anyway.
Okay.
But can you tell me how much of a role music played in your household growing up, and maybe how your father or any other family members might have influenced you musically?
Oh, man, it was a huge part of us growing up. My dad's a musician,
right.
A country and western musician, also a recording engineer. And that's where I, you know, picked up my recording skills, was basically from him. But, yeah, we were always exposed to music, always around it. We always get to see all the hot local players. Me and my brother would just go sit in the studio and watch and you know, learn from that. And it was always really inspiring, you know. It always made us want to play music. So, you know, even though my dad listened to country and all that, you know, me and my brother, from the minute that we heard Kiss Alive, knew that, you know, metal is what we wanted to do. And, you know, we kind of proceeded from there.
That's funny. I mean, growing up in my house, it was always like, my parents were from Scotland, you know, so it was always like the Rolling Stones and the Beatles, like on a Sunday when we're cleaning the house and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And was it always like country stuff, or was there?
No, man. You know, my dad was a huge, huge Beatles fan,
yeah.
Of course, you know. But yeah, he was mostly country. You know, we would, you know, walk in the house and then David Allan Coe would be playing, you know, which is really kind of strange because we ended up working
right.
with him eventually.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, like I said, once we got the music bug, you know, me and Don played our own records all the fucking time, as loud as we could do it. And, you know, once we started jamming it, it was over from that point.
So how do you think, your drumming, or if it did at all, did your drumming differ pre-Cowboys from Hell, I guess?
I think it really hasn't changed a whole lot over the years. You know, it's kind of, I've always been, had a lot of different drummers influence me, but I always liked incorporating the rudimental side of drumming into the drum set. And, you know, I think I really brought that out from the Cowboys from Hell record on through Far Beyond Driven, and still to this day, you know, I use the paradiddle things and stuff like that in my drumming. And, you know, just, you know, certain drummers come along at certain times. You know, my very favorite first drummer that really influenced me was Tommy Aldridge. You know, the first time I heard him play Boom Boom Out Goes the Lights, and he was doing all those crazy triplets with his feet and stuff.
Yeah.
I was like, man, I got to have another bass drum, you know. And I went to my dad, you know, and I said, hey, man, I got to get another bass drum. And he's like, well, what's wrong with the one you got, son? I said, nothing, I need two. And he said, two bass drums? And I'm like, yeah, two bass drums, dude. So he hooked me up, and, you know, it was on from there.
That's funny, man. You're not the first person that's actually said that to me in an interview, and it's funny each time I hear it, man. Yeah, what do you mean you need two?
Yeah, exactly.
So you're looking back at what was available in the early 80s, what do you think has been like the biggest improvement for you in music, meaning looking at the gear you played, recording technology, promotional tools, what's made the biggest impact now as a musician with the current scene and what's available versus...
Oh, I'd say without a doubt the invention of digital audio, you know, I mean, being able to record, you know, in Pro Tools in such a, you know, before it was such a mammoth task, you know, to get these amazing sounds, and, you know, you had to have these $100,000 consoles and, you know, all kinds of analog gear and really just fill a room full of everything. And now you can walk out of the studio with your laptop and have the whole recording session in it, you know.
Yeah.
It's pretty insane.
Yeah, it's making it a lot, of course, easier for a lot of people. But then, you know, you see the downside of it now where, you know, half of the stuff we hear on some of these records, and don't get me wrong, I love it all, but, you know, the sound replacement's gotten to be, I think, too much of a habit, you know, and we're not really hearing what drummers are actually doing, which kind of sucks.
Right, right. No, it's definitely a two-edged sword, you know. I mean, when I listen back to like Moving Pictures by Rush or any of my classic records, there's so much depth there when you listen to the record because it's analog, and it has all that natural compression on it and everything. And digital really does sterilize it quite a bit. And then, of course, like you said, it's made it real easy for half-assed people to get away with it. They can go in there and, flub their way through things, a la Lars Ulrich. And then they can sit there and have the engineer fix it all for them,
That's
But
funny.
and nothing against Lars. I mean, we all do that stuff. Everybody does.
I'll take
But
that out.
yeah, I mean, we're buds, man. He knows I'm just taking a dig at him. But no, like I said, everybody does it. And it just really, it's an A. It's a time saver. And B, it's just too easy to say, chop that one right there and just use the same one over.
Exactly,
Yeah.
Go into the studio, hit each drum once, and see ya.
Yeah.
Man, it's funny you said that, like, 'cause Lars, I mean, I've seen some of the stuff he's done recently, and if I were to make a poke back at him, I would just be like, I just want to know what kind of snare drum head he's using, because it seems like the only thing he's hitting these days, is just the snare with all his fills. It's kind of, it's crazy, but yeah, you can't take away from what he did,
Right. Ah, he's a great, great writer of drum parts, especially back to like Master of Puppets and stuff like that. The parts are incredible parts,
Yeah, I remember. So what's your favorite song, Pantera, to play live?
Oh, man. Probably one of the most challenging ones that we ever did was Slaughtered off of Far Beyond Driven. It's got some real, pounding double kick stuff, and it's just a really demanding song all the way through. And I just remember, every time when we got to the end, that ba-da-ba-da-ba-da-ba-da-ba-da, the whole fucking crowd just go crazy every time. So that was, far as technically difficult and really demanding, that was probably the most. And then, of course, playing a song like Cowboys from Hell never ever got old just because everybody loved it so much,
Right. Talking about crowds going wild and stuff, that was another question. Looking back at like Monsters of Rock in Moscow 91 or 92, Monsters of Rock in Italy, and then even as far as 98, 99 with the shows you guys did in like Chile and Argentina. Which show of that magnitude was the most memorable to you, and why?
The 92 Monsters of Rock in Moscow was just incredible, man. It's we'd actually been off the road for about a month, and we were already in the studio recording Vulgar Display of Power, and we got a call from our A&R guy, said, "Hey, how would you guys like to go open a show for AC/DC and Metallica in Moscow, fucking killer, well, pack your shit, you're flying out and you're playing next Tuesday, I mean, it was like that quick." And so we didn't really have a chance to rehearse or get back into live playing mode. We just flew over there, and once we got there, we had no idea the magnitude of the size of how many people were going to be there. They estimate nearly 1 million people, which is twice as big as Woodstock. I mean, it's just fucking
Right.
huge, And it was basically a gift from, they just had the coup in Russia, and it was a way for us to kind of westernize them with our music because our music had never been available over there before except on the black market, So it was like a gift from Time Warner and a way to introduce the people of Russia to Western music, And so we flew over there, we played, we did 30 minutes. It felt like it went by in 10 seconds.
Right.
The crowd treated us like Led Zeppelin, and it was amazing. And then we got to sit on the side of the stage and watch Metallica rip it up. And then, of course, AC/DC got up and killed it. And it was an amazing event, It was something I'll never forget. And then they actually made a documentary about it called For Those About to Rock. That's really cool. And I don't know if it's still in print or not, but you could probably find it on the internet somewhere. But yeah, it's a really amazing. And the show was, the Russian army didn't know what to expect, and when these kids and the people there started going crazy, they just started beating them.
I saw that.
There's just all kinds of insane beatings going on while we were playing, and it's just because they didn't understand,
It's fucked up. I mean, I saw, like, I remember watching some of the footage, and, like, you see American flags flying everywhere, and they're going nuts, and the guys are just standing there, like, marching, like, in lines, like Third Reich and shit, with, like, these batons behind their backs. Like, just, yeah, they're probably scared out of their minds, like they're going to be, like, overturned or something.
Yeah, it was crazy, man. And I remember, them saying, these people work for rubles, and they make about, 30 rubles a month, and that's equivalent to like $10, man. I mean, it's just insane. I bought me a whole Russian army outfit, in Red Square for, $5, I think, man. I mean, it was just crazy at you know how much of a different world it was, you know,
Yeah.
especially back then.
It's crazy. There's a lot of bands nowadays too, like, Misery Index and Despised Icon and all these new up and coming, extreme metal guys that are going over there and they're playing Russia, and it's the same thing, but of course it's a little more liberalized now, but it's still the same experience, I guess, they get from the fans of the big woe factor, because
Oh yeah, they're blown away when they see it, you know, because they just don't get it, you know, they don't get it that often, and when they do, they go crazy, man, they love it.
right on. So, Pantera's DVDs, have been kind of famous over the years for backstage antics and whatnot. Can you tell us like a funny story maybe that didn't make it into a DVD that you were involved in over the years that
Oh man, I think almost everything we ever did made it into a DVD of sorts, man. Yeah, that was one rule that Dom always had, is always have the camera rolling, always have the camera with you. You just never know when you're going to catch that Kodak moment, you know. So I personally can't really recall something that, you know, was just you know, crazy and worthy of being on video that didn't wind up on there. I mean, everything. I mean, you know, when you watch the Pantera home videos, you feel like you live a day in the life of being on the road with Pantera. You know, it's just everything's exposed. Our crew is part of it. We're part of it. You know, it's got the good sides. It's got the bad sides. You know, the best part of it is obviously playing on stage. But you know, to keep ourselves sane, you know, we did a whole lot of cutting up. You know.
That's cool. There was obviously a loyalty, to say the least, that you guys shared in Pantera. Was there a lot of offers back in the day for like you or Daryl to join other projects? Did that happen a lot, or did it never happen?
Well, not after we got signed to a major label, you know. But when we were shopping, you know, we'd been turned down by every label on the face of the earth 22 times, and you know, word got out that Don was a hot guitar player, and you know, bands would come and sit in and jam with us, and you know, the next thing you know, Megadeth's calling him up and offering him a Nike endorsement, and you know, $100 a week in PDs, and you know. What else? You know, just health insurance shit that none of us had back then, you know, and it seemed pretty tempting, but you know, he's basically told Dave, you know, look, dude, if you want me to come play in your band, you got to bring my brother. And he's like, well, we already got a drummer. And he goes, well, then tough shit, dude, I'm not doing it, you know. And we stuck together, you know, we rode the storm out, and literally we got saved by a storm. You know, the way we got our record deals, there was an A&R guy that was flying to North Carolina to see this band called Tangier that they just signed to Atco Records, and that big Hurricane Hugo hit, and he had a layover, so he was stuck here in Dallas, and he called the president of the company up in New York and said, hey, is there any bands here in Texas you want me to go see? I'm stuck here for the night. And he goes, well, yeah, as a matter of fact, there's this band called Pantera that's been mailing me stuff over the years, and the records are really great, but why don't you just go see them, see if they're any good live, you know? So the dude calls me up on the phone, you know, and I pretty much had it with A&R people at that point, you know. I was just tired of messing with them. Just to me, it just seemed like I, you know, one way or another, we've got this offer on the table from Roadrunner. You know, if we set it out a little longer, we'll just take that, you know. This dude calls me up and goes, you know, hey man, is there a, he had this real deep voice. His name was Mark Ross, son of Steve Ross, who used to run Warner Music.
Right.
Anyways, he calls me up, hey man, are you guys playing anywhere? You know, I need to come see you. It doesn't matter if you're in a rehearsal space or what. And I said, well, yeah, as a matter of fact, we just happen to be playing this Mexican disco tonight, man. It's this girl's birthday, and she hired us to play a private party, you know. So told the cat where it was. It was just this little Mexican dive over in Fort Worth. And so we got over there. We set up all our lights, the sound, and, you know, really was serious about it. Got it all dialed in. And anyways, the dude shows up. Big, tall guy. Could pick him out of the crowd just like that. No problem at all. Anyways, we got up and started playing, man. We were just slamming, just tearing it up, you know, and felt really good about it and everything. And about four songs in, you know, the dude walked out the front door, and we're like, oh, man, he just left, you know. Now let's just start drinking and start partying, you know. So we started slamming whiskey and drinking, throwing birthday cake all over the place, and, you know, Dime and Rex and them were sliding all over the floor. And the next thing you know, hey, man, he came back. He's back, man. Get serious again, you know. So we finished up the set, you know, and I went over to the dude, and before I could say anything to him, he goes, dude, oh my God, that was the most incredible live band I've ever seen in my life. And I said, well, why'd you leave, dude? And he goes, well, I went out to my car to call the president and tell him that we're signing you to the label. You know, I was like, wow, you know, so that's how it happened, man.
Nice. Here, have a shot, dude.
Yeah, exactly.
Were you ever in any bands that didn't involve your brother before Hell Yeah?
Well, before
Before
Pantera,
Pantera, man.
no, man. I was the first band that I'd ever started, and the first version of it didn't include my brother because he was so young at the time. But when it was the same thing, once we got rolling, I insisted on him being in the band, and reluctantly the other guys finally let him join, and eventually, the guitar player that we had, which was Terry, basically just quit playing guitar because Don was just shredding, and
Yeah,
he
he
just
was.
started singing,
Yeah, he was fucking ridiculous, man. I saw something posted online a couple days ago that Rex had said there's gonna be a Pantera box set released later this year. Is that true or?
Well, we're working on it. We never were a band that did extra songs when we went to the studio. We always felt like quality was the number one. We never could understand why these guys would get together and say, "Well, we're going to go write 40 songs and then record them and hope that 10 of them turn out good enough to make a record." That's just bullshit. How about writing 10 really good fucking songs? And that's what we focused on. So I've been digging through the archives, and I've come across a few things, and we're definitely going to have some live bootleg stuff on there, and really just going to try to make it special, so definitely working on that. And then I start recording the new Hell Yeah record with those guys. We start recording in May, so I'm excited about that.
Cool.
And then in the meantime, I've been staying busy with Seventh Void, which is coming out on my label April 21st. It's Johnny and Kenny from Typo Negative, and it's some of the most slow, heavy, sludgy stuff you ever heard in your life. I mean, it's just really amazing. It's kind of a cross between old Soundgarden meets Sabbath with a little Audioslave thrown in there. So
Nice.
been staying really busy with that lately.
It's yeah, we actually just got an email yesterday about that with Kenny, and we're gonna be doing we have a drum competition that I started last March. It's called Blast Off, and it was, the idea was just, like a guitar center drum off, but just metal guys and judged by just metal, judges. And it, went over pretty well the first one, and now we've taken it to like a digital thing online where people are just, recording videos like, of them performing, and then they get judged by, whoever, Timmy Young and, this and that. And they contacted us yesterday through Metal Injection because we work with them on this Blast Off, and they wanted to throw some prizes in, to promote that new record. So that was pretty cool.
Kick ass, man. I'm excited about it.
Yeah, that's cool. Have you ever paid any attention to any Pantera tribute bands over the years?
Ah, man, I've seen quite a few of them, and they're always a gas. The drummers always get the parts wrong. But they're always going for it, and God bless them, man. It's fun to check them out, I mean, I can't think of another band that has as many tribute bands as we do, and just getting to see them, it's always fun. I mean, these guys, they go for it, balls out as hard as they can. They generally don't look anything like us, but they do everything else they can do to kind of imitate us, and it's always good to see them, man.
That's funny. So you mentioned a couple influences earlier in the call here, and I know that, I've seen you had listed Neil Peart as one of your biggest
Oh yeah.
influences. Is he still like number one guy or for you?
Well, tough to say. I mean, there was a point when I was all about the more drum thing, where I had the big set of extra eight toms all the way around and stuff way back in the day.
Yeah.
And when it comes to that type of drumming, nobody could touch him, But
Right.
as far as just kind of straight ahead and metal, man, like I said, I always was a fan of Tommy Aldrich, and then Mickey D has always been a huge influence on me. It's way back to the King Diamond days, man. Abigail and all that shit was just fucking amazing drumming on those records. And he still kicks fucking ass in Motorhead, So those were the main ones. And then I always loved Alex Van Halen. I loved his feel. I liked his sound. It was unique and very different. And then of course the King, John Bonham. He was always a big influence on me too.
Right. It's funny that you say that about the Alex's sound. It was very unique, especially the later stuff.
Oh yeah. Yeah, he's always experimenting, and he's never, I don't think I've ever seen him with the same drum set on any tour ever,
Right. Here's a humbling question for you, and it's kind of weird for me to ask it, just first time talking to you or whatever, but do you realize, that you are an icon in metal drumming history?
I never really crossed my mind while
Well,
things were going so full blast. But I got a magazine from England, which was a drum magazine, and they sent it to me, and it's like I guess the biggest drum magazine in Europe. I can't remember the name of it, of course.
I think it's just Drummer.
Yeah, I think it's not. Yeah, it's just called Drummer, right?
Right.
And it just said, you know, legendary legends or something like that on the cover, and it had John Bonham on it, had Keith Moon, had Buddy Rich, had a picture of me on there, and you know, Neil Peart. I mean, there was like every one of these people that I've always looked up to and freaked out on, and then there's my picture up there with them, and I was just like, wow, you know, that's pretty, like you said, pretty humbling, and just kind of, you just go, wow, you know, that's pretty amazing that people will, you know, look at me in that same light, and I just, it just blew me away, you know. I really had to sit down for a minute and just think about it. I was like, do I really fit in with these guys? You know, these dudes are so great, you know. And
well,
anyways, it was cool, you know.
Right on, it's got to be cool, and fitting in or not fitting in, I mean, the progression of what music had to offer, I mean, you learned from those guys, and here's what you created, I mean.
Right.
It's always going to progress, and there's always going to be different icons and whatnot. I mean, after seeing that, did it change anything about the way you approach your drumming career, or you know, the way that you maybe handled press releases or anything because
no,
of that
no,
status?
Not really, man. You know, I've always kind of been, even back to the early Pantera days, kind of the mouth of the band. You know, I was always more than just a drummer. You know, I wanted to be able to be a producer of the records, you know, which I did co-produce all the records, an engineer, and then also, you know, the spokesperson, so to speak. So that's something that me and Lars have quite a bit in common with, you know, that I think, you know, our names are kind of household just because we did do, you know, more than just play the drums, you know.
Right on. Yeah, then Mike Portnoy, of course, also named you as one of his main influences.
Oh, I love his playing, too. We've been buddies for years, and I was having fun watching him on that metal show the other day with Eddie Trunk and those guys, and I was just on that show recently, too.
That's cool. He's a... It's got to be strange when you see someone like him with the, you know, different progressive approach he took to drumming, you know, versus the style of drumming that you have. Obviously,
right.
Nothing wrong with it, but it's great to see, you know, that he appreciates his roots, obviously, you know, just by listing you as an influence, you know. It's just, I thought it was pretty wild. I was like, wow.
Cool, man.
Is there any musician out there now that if they came to you to work on something, you'd drop everything and go, yeah, fuck, let's do it?
Oh man,
who would that guy be?
Yeah, it's you know, be tough to say. I mean, there's a lot of people that I really appreciate, respect, and admire. You know, I guess probably at the top of my list would probably have to be like Eddie Van Halen. You know, got to know Eddie pretty good before Dime passed, and you know, we became pretty good friends. And you know, he turned out to me to be, you know, a really genuine, sweet person. And his talent and everything that he's ever done, I've just been blown away by my whole life. So I guess if there was one dude I could sit down and jam with, that'd probably be it, man.
Right on. Is there any talk of, we mentioned David Allan Coe, is there any talk of doing any additional work with him in the future?
Man, that whole Rebel Meets Rebel thing was pretty much masterminded by Dime, you know. It was his idea to kind of get the whole thing going. And I really can't see it, you know, happening without him being part of it.
Right. Okay. Let's see here. I mean, there's not too many questions left. I'm trying to kind of organize them in my mind so it can go in some kind of flow. But
cool.
What would you say would be like the most heaviest or most extreme band, you know, slash drummer that you've heard recently? And what do you think of the advancements that drumming has been taking in general?
My personal opinion is it's lost a lot of the groove orientation in place of speed, and I'm not really a huge fan of as fast as you can go.
Right.
You know, I mean, I can appreciate it, and it's definitely a skill there, but as far as making music goes, it doesn't go a long ways for fucking making you want to tap your foot or, you know, bang your head or anything like that. It's just so fucking over the top, man.
Yeah.
And, you know, I always felt like when I use double bass, I usually use it to really, you know, give the song a kick in the ass or pick it up and go, accent it, you know, to really make it, when it comes in, you feel it, you know. It's like you dropping your car into fucking third gear or whatever, you know. And a lot of these cats today, they start off in third gear and they got nowhere to go, you know.
Yeah.
And it's the same triggered drum sound, and it just, you know, it almost sounds like a computer's playing it all, you know. So I'm not against it at all. I mean, I can appreciate it and everything, but to me, it doesn't have quite, I guess, the taste and just the rhythm that I really dig. I like things that I can really groove to. Things that just fucking, I don't know. Example, any rock and roll. I mean, just metal too. I mean, Judas Priest. It's something as simple as Living After Midnight. I mean,
Right.
it's got a fucking beat, and it's something you can't keep from banging your head to, whereas a lot of this other stuff that comes out is just, it's just like I said, it's just, you just want to drop your jaw and go, wow, but after 45 minutes of it,
Yeah.
or, it gets to a point, but,
The
the
irony.
Adler from Lamb of God, he plays some pretty tasty stuff, and he can get up and go. I've seen some of these cats on, what's that guy? I'm trying to remember his name. Supposedly the fastest drummer, Mangini or whatever. I was just like, dude, that dude's insane, I mean, even drummers don't get what he's doing sometimes,
Yeah, he is insane, man. And there's a lot of guys out there pushing the boundaries of speed, and yes, a lot of it does tend to lose the feel. I agree with you there, but the irony to me that of it all is this goes back to what we said a few minutes ago about how you looking at that magazine cover with Bonham and this and that, and there's you. This is the same thing. I mean, it's like here's these kids. And the progression of the time differences between Bonham and you to the new drummers and you, this is what they took from the shit you did, and other bands like you guys and Sabbath and Priest and all these other bands that late 80s, 90s were doing the heaviest shit in the world. Well, I don't know. That's what it progressed to, and fuck, I don't know, man. Like it or not, it's insane, man. 270 beats per minute. I mean, John Longstreth plays in Origin, and yeah, I can see after a half an hour of it, some guys can't take it or whatever. But it's funny how it all comes from the progression of what's before you. And you would never think playing any of the stuff that you guys came up with that it would lead to these guys just sitting there, doing like for an hour straight. It's fucking crazy.
And like I said, to me, I'm always been a song-oriented guy. When I listened to the, when I created my drum parts, they always had to fit the song. It wasn't me just playing drums to be playing drums. And I always felt like that you could play enough to keep drummers interested, and not so much that it goes over the average listener's head. People that don't play drums don't know what that noise is or what that is when you're going 5,000 beats a minute. They just, they don't know what it is. They just either can move to it or they can't,
That's funny, man. Well, let's see, after 30 years roughly in the music industry, the knowledge you've gained along the way, the experience you've got with labels, promoters, recording agents, etc. If you had to do it over again, if you were forced to, I guess, would you do anything different based on what you've learned along the way now?
Well, there's two words to the whole thing. It's called the music business, man. And the music we all love, and that's why we do this. And the business, if you don't take heed to that early on, you could wind up completely broke or not able to make a living doing what you want to do, playing music, that kind of thing. And fortunately, I picked up on most of that pretty early on, but most people don't. They kind of ignore it, and they just want to play. Somebody says, "Hey, here's a record deal, and we're going to give you, $100,000 up front." And they go, "Oh, give me a pen. I'm signing right now." They don't even want to look at it, And unfortunately, it says that you have to pay the $100,000 back in 15% increments, and this and that and the other. And it's just, there's so many horror stories out there of bands that, thought they were going to be huge and rock stars, and they end up broke, and they're jaded. They don't, enjoy music anymore because of the business side has wrecked them. So I wouldn't really change anything for as my career goes, but I would just tell anybody that's out there that's a, a drummer or any kind of musician, just get you a music book and learn a little bit about what your publishing is and this and that and the other, and just try to be, heads up when it comes to business, pay attention to it.
Right. That's a good answer. So along that line, you mentioned, you know, we know Big Vin Records. How's that going with the record label and you're producing it all?
Well, so far, you know, it's done great. I mean, I love producing. You know, that's an extension for me to almost be another kind of musician, whether it's a bass player, guitar player, or even a songwriter, you know, because the drums is really the only instrument that I'm truly, you know, I'd say that I'm a true player of. You know, I don't play bass, or I can play enough piano to write my own songs, and I can program keyboards like a motherfucker and shit like that. But drums is the only thing I'm accomplished at, you know.
Right.
And so being a producer helps me, you know, help the other guys create their guitar parts, the hooks, you know, parts and songs. It's just an extension for me, which I really enjoy. And then the record company thing, you know, came along. You know, I thought about, me and Dime actually thought about doing it several times and just never had the time to do it, you know, because we were just so busy with Pantera and everything. And then when I kind of got, finally started getting my life back together after what happened with my brother, I knew that we had this record with David Allan Coe done, and it meant really a lot to him, and it meant a lot to me, and I thought it was very special. And I took it around to, first of all, to my label, Elektra, that I was still signed to, and their exact answer was, well, we don't know what to do with this. I'm like, okay, showed it to another label or two, and they're like, well, what is it? We don't know. And I'm like, fuck it. You know what? I know what to do with it. Just start my own fucking label and put it out. And so that's what I did. You know, I got a distribution deal through Fontana, which is Universal.
Right.
And it just started from there. You know, I put that out, and then Dime Vision, and then I put a Christmas record out for my dad on an artist named Lisa Lane, who's an amazing female singer.
That's cool.
And then, like, my first major signing that I'm putting out is the Seventh Void thing. And then, of course, I've got my eyes out on some other things. I've got 5 million demo tapes here that I've got to keep sifting through. And I got enough stuff on my plate to keep me very busy these days.
That's cool, man. I got a bunch of those on my desk, too. Everybody wants to be featured in Sick Drummer, and I get 30 CDs a week sometimes.
Wow.
It's pretty cool. I have a couple more questions here. You good?
Yeah.
So, okay, why the switch to D-Drum?
Man, I tell you, I you know, was with Pearl for a very long time, and it just, I wanted to extend myself more than just being able to have a signature snare. You know, I wanted to have my own kit. My own, almost like my own brand, you know, my own hardware, my own pedals and stuff, and I couldn't do that with Pearl. They wouldn't allow me to go any further with what I was doing. And so, you know, D-Drum came to me and they started, you know, really just beating my door down. They're like, dude, you know, we'll do your own line of drums, whatever you want to do, you know. And I'm like, oh man, if you guys are serious about this, you know, I'm coming on board, because you know, that's what I want to do, you know. And so, we hooked up with them, and of course, they're owned by the same guy that owns Dean Guitars, too.
Terry.
And so there was kind of a family thing there. Dime was always kind of, you know, hey, dude, you got to come over and play D-Drum, you know. And then they'd already had a pretty decent roster started before I came on. And then, you know, once they brought me on, I mean, everybody's been, you know, knocking on their doors. And their drums are great, man. The drums sound fantastic. And, you know, when I first came on, the main thing I wanted to get square with them was the hardware. You know, we gotta do better than what you got here with this hardware. So we've got a new line of hardware that's really killer. The pedals are almost done, the Vinnie custom pedals, which feel just amazing. I love them.
Nice, man.
And then, of course, the drums, you know, we're gonna be able to have the, I call them square drums, you know, the extra big kick drums and the toms available to the public, whereas they've never really been available before.
Very cool, man. Good for you. That's awesome.
Thanks, man.
Terry's a cool guy, man.
All those guys over there are super, man. I really enjoy working with them.
I mean, back way back in the day when he started D-Drum, he owned the music store, you know, and then like, he just came up with the idea, whatever, let's just do the drum thing, and then started endorsing like guys like Steve Azeum and shit like that, and he just was just, wow, man, you know, just came out of nowhere.
Well, they're really, really hungry and really aggressive, and that's one thing I really liked about them.
Nice. Is there any unreleased material that you know of that might be released, or any DVDs or books that you might be planning on yourself?
Well, we just put out the Dime book, which was something that was really important to my dad to do. He pretty much orchestrated it, and then, of course, I came on board to, you know, make sure it was the right thing to do and everything. And it's a really, really great tribute to my brother, and it's like I said, it was a way for my dad to kind of put his touched on Dime's legacy, and bring that forth. Writing a book on myself, man, I've been working on a cookbook for years that I'm thinking about putting out. It's called Drumming Up an Appetite with Vinnie Paul. And I love fucking cooking, and it's got a picture of me behind the drums with a big turkey leg in one hand and a drumstick in the other, you know. So, anyways, that'll probably be the first thing that I put up book-wise for me. But it'll all be in fun, man. It's, you know, like I said, I love cooking. And that's
so do I, man. That's fucking hilarious, and it's awesome.
Oh, yeah, man. It's a cool thing. And, like I said, my main cat these days is Hell Yeah. You know, we did really good with the record. We nearly went gold, and in this day and age, that's nearly impossible. And we're getting back together starting in May to write another record, and then, of course, we'll be touring for it later in the fall whenever the record gets done and we put it out. So those are the main things that I'm looking forward to.
So the book, He Came to Rock, right?
Mm-hmm.
Just went gold in Canada, correct?
Actually, the book has only been out for about 2 months. And we put out a DVD, which was called Dime Vision, at the same time that we did Rebel Meets Rebel. And it went platinum in Canada and gold in the United States. So it's very popular, and it did really well. And then the Rebel Meets Rebel thing, we did over 100,000 units of that, which, you know, was pretty insane given the type of music that it was and just such a, you know, unique and different thing.
What can you tell me about Trey Diablos and Gasoline?
Oh, man. Trey Diablos was basically just me, Diamond Rex, and that, you know, means three devils. And,
right.
You know, we would just fuck around in the studio and do ZZ Top songs and stuff. It kind of had a ZZ Top vibe. It never was anything original. It was just covers that we would do, stuff that we, you know, grew up playing in the nightclubs, you know, Beer Drinkers and Hellraisers. And I think we actually put a track, well, we did put a track out. It was on the wrestling, I'm trying to remember, oh, fuck, what was it? It was a ZZ Top song. We did I can't believe I can't remember the name of it.
But it was published. Was there anything else? Like, did you guys record a bunch of that stuff or not?
Yeah, some of that stuff's on tape. I'd have to dig it out of the studio. And then Gasoline was basically started by me and Dime back in 99 when Phil and Rex didn't want to play on New Year's Eve anymore. They just fucking said, we're not playing on New Year's Eve anymore. And we're like, why, dude? It's the funnest fucking night of the year. What are we going to do, sit at home and watch, you know, Dick Clark rocking New Year's Eve? Fuck no. We're going to put together a fun band called Gasoline. We're going to go play, you know, Ted Nugent, Pat Travers, and Thin Lizzy, and, you know, all this crazy stuff that we grew up listening to that, you know, we don't do anymore. And so, you know, every year we would kind of have different members, and we'd get together a couple days before New Year's Eve and rehearse. And I've carried on the tradition the last couple of years doing kind of an acoustic version of Gasoline, which, you know, we do all kinds of stuff that really works well acoustically but still rocks, like, you know, Stone Temple Pilots, stuff like that. And it's always just a good time, man. You know, everybody shows up, we get drunk, it's a big bash, and Gasoline disappears, and then it comes back 2 days before New Year's Eve, man.
All right, man. One more question. Where's your favorite place to be, whether it's a vacation place or somewhere you've toured or home? Do you have a favorite place?
Oh, man. Well, you know, I just bought me a house in Vegas, and I go back and forth between Dallas and Vegas. I love Vegas. It's a great place. My favorite place I've ever toured outside of the United States was Australia, man. I loved it there. It reminded me of just one big Texas. The people there are super friendly. They love Americans. They love our music, and they just really are hospitable, and they always get that good on you, mate, and all that good stuff going on for them. So it's just a great, great place, man.
Well, it's been fun talking to you, man, and I appreciate, like I said, again, taking the time out. I grew up listening to you. I'm 36, you know.
Oh,
so,
cool, man.
Your music had a lot to do with my upcoming on the drums. I've been playing 25 years, and it's just a fucking honor to talk to you, man, for sure.
I enjoyed it, man, and I'm looking forward to checking out your magazine.
Yeah, we'll get you up on the cover. I'm not sure about pictures. I mean, obviously this isn't part of the interview, but I've got
some stuff I can send you, man.
Yeah, we definitely need a good 5, 6, 7 maybe high-res shots of you, and whoever gets credit, just send me the names of them so I can make sure they get credit in the issue.
All right, and where should I send them?
You can send it to Ian, I-A-N, at sickdrummermagazine.com.
Ian at Sick Drummer Magazine. The whole word magazine?
Yep.
Alright. Alright, I'll get those out to you today.
Oh, that's cool. Whatever. Take your time, but that's cool.
Alright, man. Well, enjoyed it. It was kick-ass, man.
Right on. Maybe I'll run into you at NAMM next year.
Yeah. Well, I'm leaving for NAMM in Germany tomorrow. Well, actually, Tuesday next week. So.
Right on.
This will be my first time over there, so that's, you know, I'm looking forward to that.
Cool, man.
All right, man.
Thank you very much.
Yep.
See ya.